Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. So glad you could join us today. Do conversations about race make you uncomfortable? Do they make you angry? Are you unnerved by the current political climate and what appears to be a widening political and racial divide in our country? Does it feel like you are living in a world of mayhem and you're not quite sure how to deal with it? There's a new book that digs into all of these issues and the mental and emotional practices that can help us. It's called The Quaking of America, an embodied guide to navigating our nation's upheaval and racial reckoning. It's written by Minneapolis therapist and trauma specialist Rezma Menakem. Rezma is a leading voice in conversations about racialized trauma. Maybe you read his first book, the New York Times bestseller, My Grandmother's Hands. It dealt with trauma and healing. Now, Rezma's new book deals with what he calls America's deteriorating democracy and offers some practices to help folks protect themselves and our country. Yeah, this is heavy stuff. So as I talk with Rezma Menakem, we are opening the phone lines and taking your phone calls. I want to hear from you. If you have read Rezma's work, what has stuck with you? What has he taught you about trauma and healing? Are you worried about the widening racial and political divide in our country? And what do you think the future could hold? You can call us at 651-227-6000. Again, the number is 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. You can tweet me at Angela Davis, NPR. Let's bring in our guest. Rezma Menakem is here with me in the studio, a therapist, a trauma specialist, the founder of Justice Leadership Solutions, and a best-selling author. Good morning, Rezma.
Hey, sis. It's good to see you.
I hear you over there breathing already. What's going on with all the breathing? Deep sighs.
I need to move back.
Well, no, but what does that do for us?
Well, you know, one of the things, you know, when you stop breathing, when you hold your breath, things pick up. There's a speed. There's a cadence that picks up in your body. And a lot of times we override that. And part of what I'm talking about in The Quaking of America is us really spending time, we said this before the show, spending time pausing to begin to work with and deal with the charge of race, to begin to work with and deal with the charge of the trauma that we're all experiencing, to deal with the mental drag that we've been experiencing as we've been going through COVID and all of these other things. And so breathing is one of the most important pieces in my work.
Rezma, I've always called on you to be a guest on the show, like hours after a crisis in our community, right after the murder of George Floyd, right after the verdict in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, hours after the shooting and killing of Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center. Call Rezma. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to have a chance to talk with you when we're not in such a rush, when we're not in the middle of a storm. But to be honest, as I read your book, we're still in a storm.
Yeah. So one of the things I say about white body supremacy and racism is that it is pervasive and persistent. And we have a tendency in this country to think about it as episodic. Like when a black body is murdered in the street on film, we think that it's an episode as opposed to a continuing feral thing that happens to the black community. And so for me, my work really is about how do we begin to contend with that as opposed to always wanting things to go away. And so I'm really glad that we have time to kind of explore into these things as opposed to, you know, when a black or indigenous body is murdered or missing, we just sit around and go, and we're shocked, right? But then there's no follow up.
You know, you were doing this work of educating people about racialized trauma and how to deal with it for many years before the killing of George Floyd. But it wasn't until after that happened in 2020 that you gained national attention. Your first book, My Grandmother's Hands, it had been out for years, since 2017, mm-hmm. but it only became a bestseller in 2020 when there were suddenly all these new conversations about race taking place. And I'm just curious, what do you make of that? Because you had already established a career of doing this work, but now suddenly everybody wants to listen.
Well, you know, I think the way that I think about, first of all, I want to say that I would love it would help my heart once we get to a place where these conversations can happen without a murdering of a black body or the destruction of a black body. I would love that for us just to begin to talk about how do we begin to heal without the without the precedence being a murder. And so for me, I think the graphic nature of what happened to the murder of brother George Floyd made it so people started looking for other things, and they started looking for, well, what's going on, or how do I understand this? And I had already, because of my grandmother's hands, I had already written my grandmother's hands, not necessarily remember the one of the culminating pieces in my grandmother's hand was the death of Tamir Rice. That's the thing that kind of shocked me and my wife into like, what, like, This can't be. We're watching this on TV. And so for me, it really is about, how do I, kind of keep doing what I need to do, even when nobody's listening to me. I have to, you know, we have to keep building even when nobody's listening to you, 'cause you may be putting something in place that people can use later on.
So how are you handling all the newfound attention? You're doing national tours, yeah. Huge audiences now. Mm-hmm. How does that affect you personally? How's your life changed?
Well, I you know my wife. Mm-hmm. She keeps me very grounded. And my kids keep me grounded. And then I have a community, you know, people like you, people like other people who check in on me. What's starting to happen is that people are seeing what I'm doing. And, you know, one of the things about attention is that you get both good and bad attention. Mm-hmm. And so the kind of death threats have increased, you know, and we've had to take precautions with that. But when I hear from you, I hear from other people and they say, hey, I'm just checking on you, brother. I love you. I care about you. I'm just making sure you're all right. That helps me tremendously.
I think we saw during the pandemic, a lot of folks, as we all turn to our support system, let mm-hmm. me call that one aunt. Let me call that one friend. Mm-hmm. Let me call my grandma, that person who has always been our go-to support person. Mm-hmm. That when we called and reached out to those people, that they were hurting and falling apart too. And that created a real problem for folks. Yeah. And I think brought on a lot more interest in self-care. Mm-hmm. Do you find that to be true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things that I worked with some artists when I wrote My Grandmother's Hands, and they did an album, and one of the songs on the album was called Strong Friends. And the whole chorus is, make sure you check on your strong friends, right? Mm-hmm. We always used to, like, you know, we go to them. But, you know, the weight of white supremacy and white body supremacy, like I said earlier, is persistent. And so it, just because I'm writing about it doesn't mean I go unaffected by it. Mm-hmm. And so, we have to begin to look at the people that we rely on and say, hey, I'm checking on you too.
Let's talk about your new book, The Quaking of America, which, as I showed you, it looks mine's a little beat up right now because it's a journey, this book, and which mm-hmm. I have not finished yet. Mm-hmm. 370 pages there. Mm-hmm. But I know that in early 2021, you initially planned on writing a sequel to My Grandmother's Hands.
Yeah.
But something happened in the first few months of 2021 yeah. that changed your mind. Let's talk about what was going on.
So as you know, when you have a successful book, one of the first things that your publisher wants you to do is write that same book again.
Do that some more.
Let's do that. So you know, I obliged. I was like, okay, I have something in me around that. And the book that I started writing was called Our Grandchildren's Souls, mm-hmm. right? And it was talking about legacy of building a cultural legacy around anti-racism, right? A living embodied anti-racist legacy, not just strategy, not just DEI, not cultural competency, but how do you build a cultural legacy situated in anti-racism? And how do you pass that down to your children? Well, I'm writing the book. Me and my partner are writing the book. We get to we're almost halfway done, and January 6th happened. And when January 6th happened, it changed everything. It was like, I know that America has a very difficult time with holding on to things and remembering things and has cultural amnesia like 2 seconds after something happens. Mm-hmm. But when me and my wife were sitting there watching this and looking at each other with our mouths open, and we're seeing, you know, predominantly white folks showing up with AR-15s.
We're talking about the insurrection.
The insurrection, January 6th. Yeah. I said to myself, if I don't begin to talk about this from an embodied place, I know America. I've been here my whole life. I know that we will forget it and it will become decontextualized. And so I called my agent and I said, you're going to be mad at me because I'm not writing this book. We're not going to continue to write this book. And he goes, I'm so glad you said this because I was going to call you. It's taking about 3 or 4 days and I was going to call you and talk to you about that. We have to do something. We have to say something about this. So that shifted my whole writing, and I wanted to bring some context, and that's what Quaking is about.
You write, The Quaking of America is a book of practical embodied psychology that will help you be ready for what is to come. And I need to break the sentence down. First, what is embodied psychology?
So, you know how when you watch something on TV and you like, you have this kind of reaction to it, right? Mm-hmm. We think a lot of times that's just a cognitive experience, but that's a whole embodied experience. Your body, there's chemicals being released. There are things that are happening. All of that is, and we have a tendency to think that psychology is only in the head, only cognition, but it's actually a whole embodied piece. Your body is engaged in that. And so my whole approach in terms of dealing with trauma, to me, white body supremacy and racialization and racism is trauma, right? It is. So I have an organizing rubric when I'm working with bodies in my practice. And that is, the white body deems and has deemed itself the supreme standard by which all bodies' humanity shall be measured structurally and philosophically. If you don't understand that in this society, everything will confuse you. So if you're born in a black body, in an indigenous body, in an Asian body, just being born here can traumatize you off top if you're not housed in a white body. And if you're born in a white body, you are not privileged to be in a white body. You are literally advantaged by it. So my whole approach is, if you don't start to begin to work with the body first, you'll override and genuflect to niceness and kindness, as opposed to looking at this thing that's very feral and saying, what are we going to do to heal from it?
So, and you know, I mentioned to you before the show started, when I was watching the Senate confirmation hearings for Ketanji mm-hmm. Brown Jackson, when some of the questioning became just really, you know, rude, mm-hmm. It shocked mm-hmm. me. And I pushed away from my desk. I walked away and I walked around the newsroom in circles. Like mm-hmm. I was feeling it, mm-hmm. not just like in my mind mm-hmm. thinking like, well, this is mm-hmm. unprofessional. This mm-hmm. is, you know, mm-hmm. I felt something.
Right.
Is that an example of that?
That's absolutely an example. So let me say this, and this is where I'm trying to do in Quaking, is I'm trying to put words to those experiences, mm-hmm. right? So, because a lot of times, like even when we talked earlier, you were like, I've thought that. I've been thinking that anyway. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so all I'm doing is trying to put context to it. And so when you're watching what they were doing to Sister Brown, what you're watching is spirit murder. You're not just watching questioning. That's why you're having such a visceral reaction to it. You're saying that what they are doing and the way that they're questioning her, they're not questioning her bona fides as relates to her judicial pieces, right? They're questioning her humanity. The very sense of her being. And that's the piece that a lot of times we don't have language for. As black, brown, and indigenous people, we're watching this thing and we go, I'm feeling some type of way about this. But yet it's couched in, it's just questioning. But there is a piece that's feral. Right. And that's the spirit murder piece. And as people like me and you who are descended from people who were raped for 250 years legally in this country, right? There is something historical that shows up when we see that that evisceration happen again on TV.
And you write that this book, The Quaking of America, that it will also help us by reading it. It'll help us get ready for what is to come. Mm-hmm. I know what you believe is coming, but tell me again, what do you believe is coming after witnessing what you saw on January 6th, the insurrection? What do you believe is coming?
I believe it's here. I believe, like people say, there's this racial divide, this growing racial divide.
That was my word. Yeah. Those are my words.
No.
I said that.
Well, it's not just your words. People say that. Yeah. Everybody says that. It's like the nomenclature.
Well, what are we supposed to say?
Well, it's not a racial divide that's happening. It's already here. It already has been. The ideas that we are on this is what I say. The race question in this country is a species question first. And that's the piece that we always miss, is that we think the race question is just pigmentation. That's a part of it. But it's really ensconced in species. The term race was used to identify a race of dog, race of cat, race of bird, race of fauna. That's the way that Europeans began to talk about race. They took that idea and grafted it on pigmentation. And so the question in this country is, Angela, is Rezma, are they human? And the answer philosophically and structurally has always been no. It has always been no. We are not human based on this pigmentocracy that has been developed. So one of the things that I'm talking about in Quaking is I'm saying, look, we have to begin to understand this from our own ground, from our own moorings, and not take these kind of things that we say, like the racial divide, the looming racial divide. It's already here.
And so on page two, you say, no one can perfectly foretell the future, but many signs point to an imminent attempt to overthrow American democracy. Absolutely. And incite widespread violence, especially against Black bodies and other bodies of culture. Mm-hmm. The Civil War will likely be incited by the Republican Party and its many complicitors sometime between the summer of 2022 and early 2025.
Yeah.
And that belief is based on what you've seen in the past and what you're seeing now.
What I'm seeing in the past, what I'm seeing now, we had more white women vote for Trump the second time than the first time. Let's just let that lie for a second. After, like, the first time, you can go, okay, people were enamored by him. But the second time, you're looking at people's self-interest at that point. And we haven't, and I would say the larger collective white community hasn't dove into what their self-interest. What is it about somebody? What is it about a strong man? What is it about somebody like that, that virileness that the larger collective white community actually likes, actually leans into? And so those types of things are what I'm looking at the tea leaves. That's the setup. That's setting up this whole thing that I'm couching as a civil war, but it really is a war that's going to make people choose. Am I going to choose ushering in a living embodied anti-racist culture, or am I going to continue to be complicit in the culture that currently exists?
Do you think many people are just, they haven't really taken the time to think about all of the actions and reactions that we've seen in the last few years, because it's too uncomfortable. It's too. Right. I don't really want to think about that. I just want to move forward.
It's nasty. It's ugly. It's feral. It's terror. Right. And so for people to say, I'm going to spend time, which I'm actually asking in the book, spend time with those pieces so the quaking can begin to happen and you can begin to contend with it and go through it cleanly as opposed to going around it and keep this dirty stuff going. And so that's the whole thing. We can either say, I don't want that. That's not good. That's not nice. I don't want to contend with that. Let's figure out something else out. I want people to be kind with theirs. You could do that, but that's not going to heal what's been in the soil of this country for at least 400 and 500 years. We're talking about a, this is why people can't talk about race cross-culturally without a whole lot of heat coming into the room.
Real quick.
Real quick. That's because we have not dealt with the charge of race. We just want to deal with the idea of race when we do our DEI work or our cultural competency work. We don't want to deal with the feralness of it and what it actually means to be raced or what race actually means in this country.
So this brings me to the title, The Quaking of America. I looked up the word quaking. I'm like, I wonder why he settled on this title. Mm-hmm. And quaking means to shake or to tremble.
Mm-hmm.
Why the title of the book? Why did you title it Quaking of America?
Two pieces. I'm trying to invite people into a process that is about growth. And you can't grow without quaking, without getting to your growth edges, without getting to a place that you don't want to go, right? Getting to that place and beginning to ask yourself, who am I? And who I was, will that allow me to contend with what's happening right now? And so quaking, like anybody who's tried to learn a new skill, right? Or tried to lose weight or tried to do, right? You know, there are points in time where you get to your growth edges and you go, I'm just going to eat that. Look, today I'm eating this cookie.
I'm at the edge. Yeah.
I'm at the edge. Yeah.
That was 3 pounds. That was nice.
That was nice.
I want this cookie right now.
Right now. And we have yet, as America has yet to go through that quaking. And so the trembling is an important part of the growth. The shaking is an important part of the growth. And we and America has created a lot of different ways to get around it.
And so your mission is to educate people, to let you know that if you focus on healing, that can help prepare us for the unrest.
That's right.
And the widening divisions in our country.
That's right. So a large part of the book, that's why I break the book up. And I'm talking about what I call a somatic elicitation, something specific. And then I talk about a practice afterwards. And what that's designed to do through the course of the book is temper and condition your body to allow you to be able to work with what is right now. So it's not like we have to wait for a civil war, right? Right now, we can either prep ourselves for what we see is happening right now. So if a civil war happens, we're conditioned, we're ready to deal with it. If it doesn't happen, right, we're still in a better place to deal with white supremacy and white body supremacy in ways that we are not right now.
We're talking with best-selling author and therapist Rezma Menakem, and our phone lines are open. If you have ever read Rezma's work, listened to him speak during an interview, what has stuck with you? What has he taught you about trauma and healing? And are you worried about the widening, or should I say this anymore?
No, go ahead.
Okay,
no,
these
no,
are my words.
No, no. Yeah,
are you worried about the widening racial and political divide in our country right now? What do you think the future could hold? What questions do you have for Rezma? Call us at 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I recognize words matter. In Prior Lake, let's take a phone call, Rezma, from Audrey, who has been on hold. Audrey, good morning. And what did you want to share with us?
Good morning. I just really appreciate that you're bringing up the race question. I just wanted to share that I grew up in southeast Minnesota, right out in a very small upper class, 97% white community outside of, like, 10 minutes outside of Rochester. Rochester is one of the largest black communities in Minnesota, not to mention one of the largest Somali refugee populations in the nation. But in my small town, I've seen over the years, not only in, like, the lack of, you know, the whitewashed curriculum of, you know, the black experience in America. But also, you know, this idea that they're really resistant, the people, and, you know, even though it's just 10 minutes away from this rapidly diversifying place, the town that I grew up in is very resistant to that change. And, you know, they hear anything about the race question and they freeze up and they, you know, they want to push that away because I think it's scary to them. And so my question is, how do you approach, I mean, not necessarily you like having to pander to white people, but how, as myself, how should I go about approaching conversations with them to try and get them to care and, like, not, like, scare off or freeze up when the race question comes up.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's Audrey calling in from Prior Lake.
That's a beautiful question. So this is why I talk about ushering in a living embodied anti-racist culture, because ushering in a living embodied anti-racist culture means that what you're doing is you're getting together with other white bodies first, and you're beginning to temper and condition each other. So when you do begin to move out, you're actually doing it as a culture, as a community, as opposed to individual people trying to do things. And this work for me is my life's work. This work for most Black folks is a life work. We can't navigate this society without doing this for our lives, because we have children. We have people that are connected to us. So this is our life's work. What I've been asking white bodies is to begin to think about that in the same way. Think about race and racism and the ending of white body supremacy as your life's work, the thing that you will be passing down to your children. That means you have to get ready. And so don't worry about your 97% people who don't care about what you're doing. You get right. It's like this. If Angela, if me and you, I call you one day and I say, Angela, I'm getting ready to I want to run a marathon. And you'd be like, really? And I'd say, yeah, I'm really thinking about running a marathon. You say, I'm so proud of you. You should run that marathon. Anything that I can do to support you, I'm going to do it. And I say, and then you turn to me and you say, Resma, when you're thinking about running this marathon? And I looked at you in all seriousness and I said, tomorrow.
I'm like, no. That's a bad idea. You got to train. You haven't done your research.
That's right. This is the same thing. It's the same thing. And so often good, quote unquote, good white folks want to go out and change other white folks without doing any tempering and conditioning in order to deal with the charge of race. That's what the Quaking is all about. Get yourself together. Get together with two other white bodies and say, for the rest of our lives, we're going to commit to this, and then see what emerges from that.
Take it in steps. That's a great analogy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's take another phone call before we take a news break as we talk with Resma Menakem, who has a new book out called The Quaking of America, an embodied guide to navigating our nation's upheaval and racial reckoning. Mm-hmm. The number is 651-227-6000, or you can call 800-242-2828. In Richfield, Joyce is on the phone. Good morning, Joyce. Thanks for calling.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having this brilliant author on. I think he might have just answered my question, but I moved to Minnesota because this is where George Floyd was killed, and I wanted to be part of the solution. I came from Arizona, and then I bought my grandmother's hands first thing when this happened, and I realized that the trauma is so deep, and I'm very concerned about it. I'm very concerned about America. What we're doing, we're stopping voting rights, and I really want to be part of the change, and I have been totally unsuccessful to do anything.
Joyce, what have you attempted to do? Wouldn't you say you've been unsuccessful?
I've joined book groups that were reading all of the, white fragility and all the, just mercy, all the books that we can on the racial situation. And I'm working with a children's group to help with the trauma of childhood that has been so revealed in my grandmother's hands. But I'm feeling like I'm really not making any progress. And I did hear him say this is a lifelong project, and I guess I need to look at it that way.
Joyce, thank you for calling. Any words of encouragement for Joyce, who ran to the fire? She moved from Arizona to Minnesota.
Yeah. So the United States has over the last 10 years has made a real heavy bend towards authoritarianism. Right. There's a taste for it now in this country. And one of the ways that good people think that they need to deal with the authoritarianism or the decline or the racial divide or whatever it is to go someplace or to teach other people or to get all the books that they can and read and educate themselves. I think education is a good thing. However, there is a different type, and this is what I was saying earlier, there's a different type of education that I don't think we give enough room for, and that's embodied education. And sometimes the reason why things don't actually do what we think they should be doing is because we're not conditioned to hold what needs to be held in order for the transformation to occur. And so coming to Minnesota in order to deal with, you know, the racial stuff, I think is one thing to do. Another thing to do is to get together with two other white bodies, commit to each other that from this point on, we're going to do these practices in my grandmother's hands, and we're going to witness each other, and we're going to condition and get ready. So when we are interfacing with other white bodies, they sense room in us as opposed to instruction in us. This is a key piece.
What does that mean? Room in us rather than instruction
room,
from us.
So you ever been with your favorite uncle or auntie? Or your favorite older person, and you're in them, and you just feel better.
Yes, in right? their presence.
In their presence. That's room, mm-hmm. right? But that has to be cultivated, right? The sense of room has to be cultivated. Your uncle or your aunt or somebody had to cultivate that. So when they see you, they go, "Hey, baby," and you, right?
And you,
that's right. So that's a cultivation. So often when we talk about race, is particularly white bodies want the answer, want the toy. They don't want to explore in an embodied sense. What is it that they've learned? What is it that they've gotten? What's the texture of advantage, and how does that show up? How does that show up between white bodies?
So, do our individual work start with a small group of people individually, get stronger, and then it puts you in a place of more? You have more power, more influence.
That's it.
So
you have more power, more influence, and sis, more room. Mm-hmm. So when the difficulties happen, you have been conditioned not just in. Remember, what happened to us, like what happened to black folks, did not happen to black folks individually. It also happened to black folks communally. So only developing an individual response to a communal horror is inadequate. The same thing applies for white folks. Most white bodies who are listening to us talk right now are descended from white bodies that were fleeing something, and usually fleeing other elite white bodies who were brutalizing them. That never got dealt with. And so when white bodies get into a room without me and you present, and they begin to do this work, what begins to happen is that all of that quaking and all of that stuff that never got tended to starts to begin to show itself. And in that moment, you're being asked to make choices about who you want to be and how you want to be and what you want to pass down to your children.
Resma, back to the phone lines in Bloomington. We've got Ion on the line. Good morning, Ion. What did you want to ask or share?
Yes. Hi. Good morning. Thank you for accepting my call. Yeah. So I am Somali American. Moved here about 7 years ago from San Diego, California, where I was mostly raised. We came here when I was 10 years old in the United States. But, you know, coming to Minnesota, the Midwest, I've noticed a huge difference from California, where you have a lot of diversity. You mingle with so many different people, you know. Here, you know, my first job, it was primarily, I was the only black person in the office. Mm-hmm. And I was just so shocked. It was like the first week I kept, you know, looking around like no one is really, you know, looks like me or even, you know, brown skin. So I felt like just really outsider, and no one was really doing any effort to get to know me, you know, get to know my background or just being friendly. So I feel like America is getting better for sure. You know, unfortunately, you know, George Floyd's death had a huge impact in race in America. And I think it's improving. And I'm really grateful for that, because I have small children who are born here. And one of the things that I always do is talk to them about race, because they, you know, they're under 10 and they ask me about why is that kid brown or black or, you know, and I say, you know what, that's a good question. God created people different colors. You know, we have different hair colors. We have different heights. We have different languages. And this is one of the best gifts that God gave us. So, but the best person in the eyes of God is the person with good morals and good character and treats people with respect and gives charity. And these are conversations that I want to have with my children every day, or, you know, as regular as possible, because I know that they will grow up in America and they will, you know, unfortunately, maybe face discrimination because of the, you know, the history of this country, how it horribly it treated other human beings that were, you know, just like them. So I feel like our white parents having those conversations with their children. I know, I'm sure a lot of them are, but I feel like not most of them. I feel like they need to really address, children are the future. So they need to speak about race in their homes. They need to say, okay, you know, let me tell you, let's talk about, you know, different cultures. Let's learn about different people. And I really feel like they need to have a trip outside of America and visit the world. You know, I feel like they're not very cultural competent.
And
I don't know about other cultures.
I have a quick question for you. Are you worried about what the future holds here in America for your children? What the world will be like, this country will be like when they're adults?
You know, I'm not worried. You know, I'm not worried because, you know, when I came to the United States, I've had a lot of opportunities, and now we live in, you know, in the suburbs, we have a house, we bought a home, we're living the American dream, and I cannot get this in any other country, even my own country. So I really have hope in America. I really believe in America, and I love America, but I feel like we can do better. They, you know, especially white American families, I really think that the burden's on them. They are the majority, and they really need to do more to teach their children, not anyone, but start in a home, start in your house, talk about race more often.
I want to give Resma a chance to respond. Thank you for calling and sharing what's happening in your family. Ayan there in Bloomington, Resma, a Somali American, a mother, and she wants more conversations about race and a better understanding.
Yeah, it's that was a beautiful call.
I know.
I think this idea of hope, I think, always comes up, right? And, you know, I've been doing a lot of interviews, and people will say, Resma, I've read your book or I've done this. And, you know, sometimes it just feels like, you know, there's no hope and you don't have any hope. No, I have hope, but I just don't have hope, and I don't place my hope in the structure and the philosophy of America, right? I place my hope in what maybe people can do. But I don't place my hope in this kind of idealized understanding of America. America started off as a very feral experiment, right? When you start off with genocide and land theft and enslavement, that is a feral proposition, right? Mm-hmm. And America has yet to deal with that and contend with that.
That is our history.
That is the history, right? You know, I've been getting asked a lot of questions about CRT. And one of the things I've been saying to people,
critical race theory.
One of the things I've been saying to people is that, you know, I'm more interested in CRT than CRT. And people always go, well, what's NCRT? Non-critical race theory. The prevailing thought of this country is to be non-critical when it comes to the impact of white body supremacy on anybody that's not white. And so when I hear Ayan talking, what she's trying to say, what I hear her talking about is, I really want white bodies, white families to begin to deal with race in an earnest and honest way. And there are so many escape hatches. And so much of a pivot towards white centering, white comfort. And people are invested in being comfortable. The race question is not a comfortable question. Mm-hmm. You can't, if you go into trying to deal with race and white body supremacy by demanding comfort first, you might as well not even go into it. Right. And so for me, I agree with what Ayan said about white bodies in the collective white community has to begin to do this stuff in their homes, in their churches, in their places of work, in their cabs. Like that has to happen. And till this point, there has not been a large collective response that's tied to ushering in a living embodied anti-racist culture that hasn't existed among the white community.
What do you say when people talk to you? Well, it feels like blame and shame, and this happened a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Why are we still talking about it now?
Yeah, there's a protective response, right? So these are the responses. I talk about this in Quaking. These are the responses that the collective, the collective white body hasn't been able to contend with because they haven't had to. The collective white community has not had to deal with the vibration of race. When that vibration shifts, the images and the cognitions of race, the shifts in meaning making, the urges, the behavior, the sensation, the imagining, they haven't had to contend with it because the whole structure has been built around them being comfortable. And any overture towards beginning to talk and delve into race creates all of this heat, all of this vitriol, all of this kind of sadness and guilt and stuff like that. And what happens is that the black body and indigenous body has been conditioned in this country to the white body has taken all of that stuff and said the correct place to deal with all of that heat is to blow it through black and indigenous and Asian bodies. And the real work now is for white bodies in the larger white collective in small little conclaves with each other, right? To begin to deal with this thing of race and deal with the feralness and the charge of it.
I want to make sure we get some time to talk about elections and disinformation because you spend some time with that in the book.
Right.
You write about your predictions for what the 2022 midterm elections and the 2024 presidential election could look like if the country continues down the path that it is on right now. Describe what you think could happen.
Well, let me describe what I see happening. What I see happening is this movement towards, as I said earlier, authoritarianism. What I see happening is a movement towards making sure that LGBTQIA community members are shunned and pushed to the side legally. That's what I see happen. I mean, I'm seeing all of these laws come in. You can't say gay. You can't say this. You can't say that, right? I'm seeing a push towards banning books. Right. First of all, I can't wait till my book gets banned. I'm so looking forward to that
Why?
Day because the banning, what we don't understand is that when you ban something, that makes people want to say, well, what's in there? Right. And so I'm looking for the day where my book is on a ban list. So that's what I'm saying. I'm seeing this movement towards a feral conservatism, right? I'm seeing the George Floyd Policing Act get stalled. I'm seeing that. Think about this, sis. Think about this. Just in the last month or two, we just passed an anti-lynching act. That's recent. That's not old. That's recent. And so I'm seeing all of these pieces line up that are suggesting that there is going to be a time where we get to a place to where people who are really about ushering in a living embodied anti-racist culture and those who want to keep it the same, where there's going to be continue to be loggerheads around what type of country do we want to live in.
And also, you know, threats against election officials.
Absolutely.
Of concern.
Right.
All right. I want to take another phone call in Minneapolis. We have Adriana on the phone. Good morning to you.
It is 2541.
Okay. We can hear you, Adriana. Are you there? Adriana? Okay. Let's go to Woodbury, where Brenda is on the phone. And Brenda, what did you want to share with us?
Good morning. So my family, my immediate family is multiracial and multinational and have been for 35 plus years. And together we represent like four continents. Mm-hmm. And there are a whole lot of us families already multiracial and or multinational. And if there were a way, a network, a connection for all of us who could band together or raise our voices together, there would be a lot of us So I wish there were some network or connection, or if you know of any. And the other piece is that I feel muddled, M-O-T-T-L-E-D.
Mm. So the future of America, I mean, right now we have so many multiracial families. So these conversations about race, you really can't avoid them.
Yeah, yeah. Multiracial is different than culture, right? And people, I've even heard people that I actually respect that say, you know, what we really need to do is we really need to start having more multicultural babies, right? That's how we, I've heard that that's been a theme that's been coming up a lot, right? As a way, and this is a fundamentally misunderstanding of white body supremacy and racism, right? Racism and white body supremacy is structural, right? Meaning that the white body deems and has deemed itself the supreme standard of humanness, and every other body, this is a pigmentocracy that we're in, right? That every other body is deviant structurally and philosophically. And if you can't contend with that, now you can have multiracial friends, you can have adopted a Somali baby, you could have, you know, gotten a Korean you can have a black husband, all of that different type of stuff. That is not what I'm talking about at all, right? And if you get quaking, you'll understand what I mean. Many of us genuflect to this idea that if we can that the structural realities will be alleviated if we just start having babies and sleeping with each other. That's not going to get it. The person who owned the plantation slept with a lot of us. That does not mean that we are equal structurally and philosophically.
I can't get into the details because we're under a minute here, but I want to let people know that Resmaa is on a book tour, signing a tour. You've got events coming up across the nation, including the Twin Cities. Where are you going to be?
This Saturday, I will be at the Public Function area. If you get on my Instagram or my Facebook or stuff like that, this all up there. And so it's this Saturday at Public Function area, 6 p.m. to 12 a.m. In Minneapolis, okay. And we'll be doing a talk. And so just come on in, and then also go to resmaa.com, resmaa.com.
All right. Our time is up for the day. We will talk again. Resmaa Menakem, a therapist, a trauma specialist, founder of the Justice Leadership Solutions, and a best-selling author, the new book, The Quaking of America. This conversation was produced by Samantha Matsumoto. I'll talk to you all tomorrow morning at 9. Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder that if you want to catch my show in real time, tune in and call in weekdays at 9 a.m.